dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman whose intelligence we are always pleased to tap is with us, I'm very happy to say. Her name is Colonel Tara Oh, United States Air Force retired. She is the founder of the East Asia Research Center and one of our go-to people on what is going on, particularly in Northeast Asia, and its implications for our security interests as well as those of the people most immediately involved. Tara, it's good to have you back with us. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes. I want to visit with you about kind of the state of our alliance with South Korea. It certainly seems, given what's happening in that part of the world, mostly at the hands of the Chinese Communist Party, this is a moment when our relationship with South Korea would ideally be as strong as we could possibly have it, and yet it sure doesn't seem that way. Let's start by talking a little bit about what Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, is doing vis-a-vis China itself.
Yes, there are many indications that he is orienting South Korea towards China and away from the U.S. That is very unfortunate news.
Not just North Korea, China's sort of proxy, but towards China itself as well.
Yes, exactly. I would like to start out with the fact that most of the South Korean population, they don't want this. But the Moon administration is doing that, despite what people want. And it's done very quietly. Let me give you some examples. We know that at the beginning, South Korea accepted China's three no's, which is no additional THAAD deployment in South Korea. That is a theater high altitude air defense system. Second is no joining of U.S.-led missile defense. And three is no forming of South Korea-U.S.-Japan trilateral alliance. Right now, there's de facto alliance, but formally, officially, it's just a bilateral.
And the third party is Japan, yeah, right?
Yes. And the other one is that the year that he was elected, 2017, he went to China and he gave a speech about sharing in the Chinese dream. And he has actually repeated this since then as well. Chinese dream is about China-dominated world in that reflects China's values or CCP's values, whatever that is. But that is definitely not freedom. And then, you know, of course, we are still dealing with the coronavirus situation. And when this first broke out back in late January, the first thing that he did was not to reassure people, but the first thing that the Blue House did was to tell people don't use the term Wuhan virus or anything that shows the source of this virus, but to say new type of coronavirus. Basically, that's what the Blue House told the journalist. And the journalist all of a sudden stopped using Wuhan virus and started using new kind of coronavirus until the term COVID-19 came around. So that was his top priority, to save China's reputation rather than worrying about South Korean population regarding this pandemic. And when the doctors' organization and the public wanted South Korea to stop, Moon admission to stop entry, to ban entry from China, he never did. He refused. Instead, he said, let's suffer with China. to be a good neighbor. Let's suffer with China. I mean, that's what he said. So that's coronavirus.
So it's a lot of solidarity with China, it certainly seems. And Tara, let me ask you quickly, how does that contrast with Moon's attitude towards the United States? You mentioned that in accepting these so-called three no's from China, it's divorcing itself clearly from, among other things, having missile defenses in place that would protect American forces that are there trying to protect South Korea. That seems to be a rather unfriendly act. Is it the only one?
Well, let me just expand upon that a little bit. When he accepted three no's, he didn't even consult with the ally. And missile defense, I mean, the THAAD deployment itself, that actually protects South Korea. That is not designed to protect the U.S.
No. I just mean American troops on the ground in Korea that are there to defend the people of South Korea against the North or China or whomever. But this is something, especially if it was taken as an act without consulting the United States, is not that of a reliable ally, is it?
Well, yes. I mean, again, you know, I like to highlight the fact that, you know, most Koreans support strong alliance with the United States. And he said that in his speeches, he talks about alliance being strong. But if you look at what he's actually doing, something like, you know, accepting this without consulting a key ally, that is just not acceptable.
And Tara, is it the case that beyond these kinds of obviously defense-related actions that undermine, really, our partnership and play into this notion that he values rather more the relationship with China, he's also engaged in some things on the commercial side, as I understand it. For example, making chips available to Huawei and other Chinese companies that will help it, the CCP, that is, become a more formidable problem for us, among others. Is that correct?
Yes. He is really pressuring Samsung right now, but other companies as well. And what his party members have done is to force Samsung to publicly hand over their trade secret of their plant information to chip plant information to the courts. And then one of the lawmakers on his side of the party released that information, and a Chinese company began to produce what's called OLED, so the TV screen technology. They started producing that. So you know, this is something that they're doing. They're doing things to help China. But of course, you know, there is also the Belt and Road Initiative of China, and right now, South Korean government has denied participation, although that is occurring in South Korea. They've been denying it, but finally, it's on the Blue House website now. They are talking about linking up with China's Belt and Road Initiative.
Tara Oh, a lot of troubling information here, and its portent is something that I think it's vital that we be focused on, because my view of this is, at least, we need a strong partnership, tripartite partnership at that, with Japan as well as South Korea at this moment, probably more than at any time since the end of the Korean War. We look forward to further visits with you in the near future. Thank you so much for your time today. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang. We'll talk about, among other things, the craziness of our underwriting what the Chinese are doing in terms of intensifying the threat they pose to us. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom. With Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back, and welcome to one of the high points of our week, and that is our visit with Gordon Chang. Gordon is, of course, one of the preeminent experts on and most voluble contributors to our understanding about China, what the Chinese Communist Party is up to, and what it might mean for all of us. It is the subject of one of his terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China. It is also very much top of mind in his commentaries here and elsewhere, and it's the sort of thing that you want to be following at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter, as I do. Gordon, it's good to have you back. Welcome, sir. I want to start, Gordon, with something that we'll be talking about a bit more with Kevin Freeman in a moment, and that is the fundraising that the Chinese Communist Party is seemingly ramping up in our capital markets, even if it's action that starts in theirs, in Shanghai or Hong Kong or both. Specifically, Gordon, in the last few days, they raised $27 billion for a sovereign bond offering, a dollar-denominated sovereign bond offering, no less, that is essentially just exchanging pieces of paper for immense amounts of hard currency, and I'm told that almost 50% of it came out of the U.S. capital markets and therefore out of American investors' pockets. There's another even larger transaction pending now, which is the Ant Technology Group initial public offering, perhaps raising as much as $100 billion, we're told. Where does all this money go, in your estimation, and how ill-advised is it for Wall Street to be underwriting it?
This money goes to a Chinese regime that is configuring its military to kill Americans. And so it is hideous that we are funding this with our investment dollars. We shouldn't be trading with China at this point. We shouldn't be supporting their government. We should not be supporting their entities. I know that most Americans wouldn't agree with that, but the point is we should not be funding our own demise.
And there's no question in your mind that's what the Chinese Communist Party has in store for the United States of America, is there?
We have 219,000 Americans who have been killed by China with the coronavirus. As we've talked about before, Beijing in December and January, as well as later months, took steps that they knew would spread the disease beyond China's borders and to make it worse. So the infections and the deaths were deliberate. We also know that China is sending fentanyl into the United States. These large fentanyl gangs could not operate without the approval of the Communist Party. Last year, according to the CDC, 36,500 Americans were killed by fentanyl and other synthetics, as well as there was an increase in cocaine and meth deaths, and many of them were the result of cocktails with fentanyl. So China is killing Americans, and for us to have economic relations with that regime is just wrong.
Well, economic relations is one thing. Giving them tens of billions of dollars, which I think it's pretty clear, especially in the case of sovereign bond funds, is simply found money, which will, among other things, underwrite and enable the kinds of things you've just talked about, Gordon, is staggering. And, well, I think it's treasonous, personally. Let me ask you about another piece of what the Chinese are doing. It was addressed in a press event, I believe, last week by Mike Pompeo and the Secretary of Education, Mike Pompeo, of course, being the Secretary of State, in which the two of them talked about these Confucius Institutes that are operating on American campuses, and what a problem that represents. It's kind of a microcosm of a larger problem, isn't it, Gordon, with Chinese students and Chinese researchers and other Chinese business operations, including some tied directly to the People's Liberation Army, according to our Pentagon, that are actively involved in our country in technology theft, in intellectual property pirating, in other ways seeking to gain advantage at the expense of, you know, Americans and perhaps ultimately our lives. When you hear about this, and you learn that, understandably, in some cases, the federal government has been prosecuting some of those involved. First of all, how important is that, Gordon? And second of all, what should we make of the Chinese threat now, in retaliation for such prosecutions, to begin detaining Americans?
Well, there's a number of things there. First of all, to start with the Confucius Institutes, they have been used for inappropriate purposes. We've talked about this on previous occasions. The point is that the U.S. law enforcement is being overwhelmed by China's attempts to steal information and to engage in other criminal activities. One of the ways to deal with this is to remove China's bases in the U.S. And those Confucius Institutes are one of those bases. There's a fundamental point here, and that is we cannot have Reagan Institutes in China. So as a matter of reciprocity, we should remove all Confucius Institutes immediately. This is another symptom of an unbalanced, unreciprocal relationship. With regard to Beijing's threat to detain Americans if the U.S. continues to prosecute what they say are Chinese scholars, clearly the U.S. has got to continue to enforce its laws. And so we will have to continue to prosecute those individuals, which means that Americans in China should leave immediately. The U.S. government, for all its power, can't protect them. China can take them as hostages, and people should be leaving. And if they're not leaving themselves, they should send their dependents out, especially their minors. This is going to get worse before it gets better, and we should not be leaving hostages. So I believe the State Department should order Americans to leave.
And I guess the key point here, Gordon, is that we ignore at our peril the prospect that there will be hostages taken, that there will be Americans who lose their ability to leave China if they don't do it quickly. And we've seen this actually used as a weapon against Canada, have we not, in recent months?
Yeah. The two Michaels, Michael Korvig and Michael Spavor, have been detained since December 2018. They were detained immediately after Canada detained Meng Wanzhou, the chief financial officer of Huawei Technologies, at the request of U.S. authorities in an extradition proceeding. So China takes hostages. It's already taken Americans as hostages. There are a number of cases. So this is not a theoretical risk, Frank. China has engaged in increasingly unacceptable behavior. And by the way, behavior which violates the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations. So these agreements mean nothing. And that's therefore, I think the U.S. should order Americans to leave right away. We should be telling them that we can't protect them, and they need to get out of China.
Gordon, this hostage-taking with the Canadians, of course, was precipitated by something that we haven't talked about in a while, and I just wonder if you've got any update on it. The arrest in Canada of the chief financial officer and daughter of the owner of Huawei has been kind of a Mexican standoff, or maybe I can call it a Canadian standoff, for some months now with respect to American efforts to extradite her to the United States to stand trial. The Chinese have been threatening the Canadians in a variety of ways and have been increasingly now, it seems, intent on using extortion as well, vis-a-vis these hostages. What's the status of her extradition proceedings, as you can tell?
China's legal challenges have all been denied, but because of just the Canada's procedures, it'll probably take about another 2 years for there to be a final resolution of this. There are a number of Canadian voices who have urged Canada, Ottawa, to release Meng because of economic ties and the rest of it. Fortunately, in Canada, there has been a perceptible shift in public opinion against China, so it's unlikely that Ottawa would do that. But nonetheless, this has gone on for a very long time. And so, you know, we don't expect a resolution for years.
Gordon, let me switch gears on the last point. One of the things that we've been talking about with some of our preceding guests is the state of our alliances and efforts that the Chinese are clearly making to divide us from key regional friends and allies in the Western Pacific. One of them is Australia. And I've seen reporting that the Chinese have been very heavy-handed with the Australians. The Australians are increasingly experiencing the kind of shift you just talked about in Canada as well, an awakening to the real danger that the Chinese Communist Party represents to Australia. One of the plays that the Chinese appear to be making is to stop buying commodities that have been a very important part of the Australian economy from Australia and buying them instead from the United States, which would presumably be infuriating to our friends in Down Under. What are your thoughts on what's going on here and its strategic significance?
The strategic significance is, as you point out, Frank. Beijing is trying to divide Australia from the United States. And I think that the United States, as a show of solidarity, should just refuse to sell the commodities that China is embargoing from Australia. This points to a broader issue about economic relations among American allies. And I think that there need to be a number of conversations between Washington and Canberra, as well as others. You know, we're starting to see the real operationalization of the Quad. That's India, Japan, Australia, and the United States. And that's a very important development. Secretary of State Pompeo was in Tokyo for a Quad meeting. We are seeing the Indian and U.S. militaries act in a much more coordinated fashion with, for instance, the refueling of the U.S. Navy P-8 on an Indian island pursuant to the 2016 logistical memo. These are important developments, and we've just got to work so much closer with our allies and stand together on these economic issues, such as the boycott of commodities.
We do indeed. Gordon, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for your time today, my friend, and always for your visits to us. We'll look forward to catching up with you again next week. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman and drill down a bit more on the economic warfare of China as part of its larger, unrestricted warfare against us. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm pleased to say, with another of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio. He is the host and proprietor of the Economic War Room on Blaze TV. That would, of course, be Kevin Freeman, a very accomplished author and blogger and commentator about matters involving, well, among other things, the economic threats to our country emanating from the Chinese Communist Party. And we're going to talk about that in two blocks, I'm very pleased to say today, a special treat. Kevin has authored Secret Weapon and Game Plan, and you can find his work at economicwarroom.com and also at globaleconomicwarfare.com. Kevin Freeman, it's great to have you back, as well as having an extended chance to talk with you. Thank you so much for your time. Let me ask you first about a topic that we discussed a bit with Gordon a moment ago, Kevin, and that is that the Chinese Communist Party last week unveiled and made a killing, I think it's fair to say, with a sovereign bond offering that was dollar denominated. Now, for lay people like me, I really would appreciate what a chartered financial analyst can do to help illuminate how it is that a foreign government can issue bonds in our currency that effectively seems like it's just printing our money, giving us or our investors, among others, paper in exchange for real money, our dollars. How does that work?
Well, you have to realize that issuing a bond is essentially borrowing money. And so all this was the Chinese government borrowing U.S. dollars. Now, there are a lot of questions as to why they want to borrow U.S. dollars, what they intend to do with the U.S. dollars, and why the investors would be so foolish as to oversubscribe that loan 4.5 times so that they went after $6 billion and they raised $27.5 billion. But what they've essentially said is, we want to borrow dollars and anybody want to loan them to us. And so, you know, the whole idea of bonds, that gets a little complex. People think, you know, it's something tricky. It's really just a loan. And during the 1970s, I'll point out that there was a point where our dollar was so distrusted in the world during the energy crisis, during the Jimmy Carter days and so forth. We actually issued bonds with Swiss currency, that we borrowed Swiss franc and offered to pay back Swiss franc. And that's what the Chinese are doing here. They're borrowing money. The scary part's not that they're asking to borrow it. The scary part is that why we would be so willing to lend it to them 4.5 times what they were asking for.
I've been told that the portion of that huge amount that was made available from U.S. capital markets may be on the order of 47%. And Kevin, when you talk about sovereign bonds, am I correct in saying that these are basically completely unrestricted funds that can be applied to whatever purpose the Chinese Communist Party sees fit.
Well, that's true, but it's like our U.S. Treasury bonds. When people buy our Treasury bonds, there's no restriction on the government of what they can use the money for. The difference here, of course, is that this is the Chinese Communist Party. They have been proven to be violating human rights on their own population. They've been proven to be stealing intellectual property and all of these things that are going on in the world. And yet we continue to treat them as if they were a reasonable and normal actor in the global financial markets. And that's the real problem here. Why do we treat a communist party that's doing all of these terrible things around the world and give them a seat at the table?
You know, this calls to mind something else, though, Kevin. There have been, as you know so well, in the past two decades or so, a number of statutes and host of regulations enacted inside the United States to protect investors against undisclosed material risk or, you know, improper accounting for financial problems in various companies. When Joe Biden was vice president of the United States back in 2013, he helped engineer a memorandum of understanding with the Chinese Communist Party that has essentially enabled the Chinese to have access to our capital markets without having to be burdened by those investor protecting statutes or regulations. So when you talk about why we would treat them as a regular folk in our capital markets, that really isn't the half of it. We're treating them better than our own companies, for example. And that means that these investors are doing so, presumably not so much at their direction as at the direction of the people managing, you know, mutual funds and indexes and ETFs and the like, but not necessarily with the best interests of those investors in mind. They'll make their commissions for sure, but how does all that sort out as you see it?
Well, that's the problem, is that the people on Wall Street view themselves more as citizens of the world than they do as American firms. And you see this repeatedly in their behavior, where they give preferential treatment to those communist countries if it produces huge fees for them. And the problem goes really deeper because they've been infiltrated. And you mentioned Joe Biden with this memo of understanding. What it did was it essentially allowed Chinese companies to come into the United States, register in our markets, list on our market, our exchanges, and not provide access to the accounting of what's happening in those corporations. They are, in essence, violating Sarbanes-Oxley, which is what American companies are held to. And yet, why is it done? I think the answer may be in this laptop that everybody's talking about. You know, it looks like there may have been massive payments to the Biden family from not just the Ukraine, but also from Russia and also from China. And you wonder, can we allow such corruption to take place, whether it's on Wall Street or in Washington, where foreign governments and foreign institutions are able to buy our politicians? It's just absolutely wrong.
It's scandalous. And when you say everybody's talking about it, unfortunately, a lot of people are not informed about what's going on in these revelations simply because social media platforms are precluding them from being apprised of them, which is another scandal. One last thing on this sovereign bonds, and then I want to turn to yet another of these big deals hurtling down the tracks at us, Kevin Freeman, and that is the price for these sovereign bonds, I'm told, is at least in some of their maturity categories, approximately the same price as American Treasury bonds or Treasury notes. That suggests a confidence in the Chinese Communist Party and its economy and its system that seems misplaced to me. Am I missing something here?
Well, no, I don't think you're missing anything. In fact, I would raise the question, this is China. They're the ones who loan us money. Their economy is strong. You know, that's the mantra in the media is, how great the Chinese economy is. Well, why, if their economy is so great, are they out in every possible way trying to raise dollars? The reality of it is that the Chinese economy is very short of dollars, and they're desperately, there's a dollar shortage in China, and they're desperately trying to get as many dollars as they possibly can, which is a strange thing if they're so strong. And if they are so, if they're not so strong, why are they getting the same interest rate as the U.S. Treasury market?
Well, and then there's the other question, Kevin, which you have been really focusing attention on in Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman and on this program and on our television program now, Securing America. This question of using our dollars to help destroy the dollar as the reserve currency of the world, it gives new meaning to the old phrase, adding insult to injury, does it not?
Well, there's no question that the Chinese purpose is to de-Americanize the world and de-dollarize the world. This was stated very plainly in 2013. It's never been denied. As soon as Xi came to power, that's the first, one of the very first things that he said he wanted to do. And so that's the intention. And they want to do it with the digital currency electronic payment platform. They've tried to digitize the yuan. But that doesn't mean that during this pandemic and during what's happening around the world, if trade from America has diminished, and it has, they're running short of dollars. Their economy depends on intellectual property theft and capturing as many dollars in trade as they possibly can. And those have both been diminished a little bit during the Trump administration this year in particular. And so they're hurting for those dollars. So they need to capture them so they can continue to fulfill this plan that they very openly said they intend to do, which is de-dollarize the world.
And de-dollarize the world has profound implications, Kevin, doesn't it, for our economy, but also for our individual financial well-being?
There's no question. I mean, we may be running a $3 trillion deficit this year because of COVID-19, the pandemic, and so forth, which, I will point out that emanated from China. But because of that, we have to borrow large amounts of capital in the marketplace. And we can only do that because our dollar is the reserve currency of the world, the primary reserve currency. More people want dollars than any other currency. If China were able to break that and make it to where people wanted their digital currency or anything other than dollars, we would find it hard to raise capital, which means that our government would either have to stop spending as much, which wouldn't be a bad thing, but or raise taxes dramatically, both of which would have an impact on the economy. Ultimately, if the dollar is not the reserve currency and we have $30 trillion in debt, you head down a path of Zimbabwe or Venezuela or Weimar Germany, where you run into hyperinflation because you just have to print money. Nobody wants your currency, so you just have to print as much money as you can to pay for things.
And that is disastrous, needless to say. Kevin Freeman, we have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more with our duty expert on economic warfare and China right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are visiting with our very highly regarded colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our senior fellow, Kevin Freeman. He is also the host of Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman at Blaze TV. You can find out how to get access to that terrific program and also its battle plans, which Kevin produces for each show, just terrific resources, at economicwarroom.com. Kevin, again, thanks for giving us an extra bit of your time today. In addition to this sovereign bond windfall for the Chinese Communist Party, another one is looming, and you've done a recent program on the subject at Economic War Room. Talk about this ant Technology Group and the initial public offering that it is bringing to market, first on Hong Kong and Shanghai's markets, and inevitably, again, it seems likely to be underwritten substantially by U.S. investors.
Well, Frank, the Ant Group is the easiest way to think of it. It's an Alibaba spinoff. So Jack Ma, the communist who brought us Alibaba, is bringing Ant Group, which is a financial technology company that you could compare to Samsung Pay, Apple Pay, Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, all rolled into one. It is a financial transaction platform with $18 trillion of annual transactions and 1 billion users. So it's massive. And they plan to bring it public, not in New York, but an initial public offering in Hong Kong and Shanghai, as you suggest. Maybe the largest initial public offering in the history of the world. Alibaba was the largest to that point, which was $25 billion. It was exceeded only by Saudi's Aramco, which was approaching $30 billion. But this could be $35 billion, $50 billion. Some have even suggested as much as $90 billion offered. And when you say, wow, there's no way it could be that large, just look at the sovereign bond offering where they wanted to offer $6 billion and they had 4.5 times that. So they talk about offering $25, $30 billion, and if it goes 3, 4, 5 times that, it will be by and large the largest ever initial public offering.
And what sorts of things does Ant Technology Group do for the Chinese Communist Party that make putting that kind of money in its coffers so, well, dangerous? I don't think if there's any other word for it.
Well, if we were talking about, a European company or something else, then you'd say, well, they're offering better technology. We ought to take a look at it. The problem with China is multifold, as you know, Frank. One problem is that, well, TikTok's a primary example. You use their software, you look at cat videos, but they steal all your information. They monitor everything you're doing. And Ant Group has that same potential because a Chinese communist company must conform to what the Communist Party requires. And that means that they have to put all the data and make it available to the Communist Party, which is scary because financial transaction data tells everything about your life. And so if you're a user of this, then you have serious privacy concerns. The second aspect of that, though, is that the Communist Party, we talked about this in the last segment, they intend to de-dollarize the world. They want to replace it with a digital currency electronic payment platform. Ant Group makes digital currency electronic payment platforms. So we will be handing them, tens of billions of dollars with which they can then further this purpose of the Chinese Communist Party. And Jack Ma said before, he said, anytime the party needs anything, this company is available to them. He didn't put it in exactly those words, but anybody who read it, what he said realizes that's what he intended. And so we would hand them the money with which they could create the alternative to de-dollarize the world, which would ruin our economy.
So, Kevin, these two transactions, which are part of, but unfortunately not the entirety, of the ambitious effort that China is making to sort of not only secure the benefits of the $3 trillion by some estimates that were made possible by that Biden-engineered memorandum of understanding, but perhaps to get another trillion or so more out of us before they're done. What is the alternative? Partly we are told, well, Wall Street just can't figure out where else to put the money. They want to go where there's profits to be made. Is there an alternative? And if so, what is it?
Well, I'll give two alternatives. One of them is my personal feelings regarding the upcoming election. You've got one president who's been very hard on China and willing to confront them, the strongest on China of my lifetime, of any president in my lifetime. And you've got one candidate who was former vice president who appears to have been co-opted, or at least his family's been co-opted, purchased, bought, and paid for with billions of dollars of Chinese money and inviting people into the White House that should never be invited there. So an election choice we have. The second choice we have is, what do we do with our money? Because remember, the money that you invest does not belong to Wall Street. It's your money. It doesn't belong to your brokerage firm. It does not belong to the mutual fund. It does not belong to the ETF or the index fund. It belongs to you, to the individual. And so we have to invest our money in such a way as to benefit our country, preserve and protect and defend the United States of America for future generations. And the way to do that is to look for patriotic investing, which unfortunately is not a thing that people recognize on Wall Street yet. So we've been begun the process of training financial advisors. We've created an institute called the National Security Investment Consultant Institute, NSIC Institute. You can find it at nsic.org. And we're training at Liberty University individuals who want to be a stockbroker, a financial planner, an insurance agent, any type of investment professional, CPA, doesn't matter. If you help other people manage money and you want to help them manage it in a patriotic way, I can tell you, we've done polling. John McLaughlin did the poll for us. People want their investments to benefit their country and their family. My country and my family are the top two desired outcomes for investing. So if you're in the investment professional arena, you need to go to economicwarroom.com/advisor and register there so we can get you on the list and train you to help you help others invest patriotically. It really, our country depends on patriotic investing because our enemies are assuming that we will invest against the interest of the United States and not even know what we're doing.
Well, we certainly have given them reason to believe that. And Kevin, you know, just to put a fine point on this, I think that this idea of patriotic investing kind of harkens back to Liberty Bonds of the last century, when Americans were encouraged to invest patriotically for the war effort. What we're now watching happen with these Chinese sovereign bonds is kind of a destroy liberty bond. And I think you're absolutely right that the vast majority of Americans would not prefer to have their money going for that purpose, especially if it's not making a whole lot of money for them. Rather see it go to these sort of patriotic causes. But do you have any sense, you mentioned polling, Kevin, do you have any sense, maybe it's visceral, maybe you've got actual data on it, of your personal experience as an investment advisor, how many of us actually know where our money is going, what it's being put into, especially in these emerging market ETFs, exchange-traded funds, or the indexes that they're modeled on and the like?
Well, the comparison is stark. The people that know where their money is going are very few. The people that want their money invested in a way to benefit America and their family, it's in the high 70s. I mean, John, when I talked to him, and we did a great program in this in the Economic War Room, he said, you know, you never see that much consensus. People don't want to see their money going investing against their country. They don't want to see that happening. And yet, that's precisely what they're doing. And there's only two reasons that I can assume for that. One is that they're unaware, or two, that they're being pushed that way by firms that have more China's interests at heart than they have America's interests at heart.
Well, and this goes to really the nub of the issue, doesn't it? I think of this as treasonous activity because these Wall Street, I call them Beijing bankers, are not simply putting other people's money to work for malevolent Chinese purposes, but they're profiting personally and massively by so doing. And I'd like to think that if that weren't operating, that their own patriotic values would cause them to demur from doing this. But whether that's so or whether it's not, they're certainly taking advantage of this situation to cash in at the great expense of our country. Kevin Freeman, thank you for what you do at Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, and of course at the Center for Security Policy, and on this program and on our television outlet, Securing America, on America's Voice News. Check it out, folks, and come back to us again tomorrow if you would. Kevin, we'll talk with you next week. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.